Islam embrace poverty? This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salam.
And now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ayyub Rashid.
Respected brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam wants us to remember death. But when we remember his death, then of course we see that it was a musibah. For Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, when he was in far area, he was taken from Medina. From Medina, he was taken to Baghdad. And it was in that area when he was in Baghdad. He was poisoned. Imam alayhi salam, when he was in the moment, now he's about to die. It was a difficult moment for him. But Imam alayhi salam, can you imagine the poison? It affected Imam alayhi salam until he passed away. It was a calamity. It was musibah. But wallah, when we remember Imam al-Jawad, then we remember that, yes, his father, Imam Ali bin Musa al-Ridwa, also was poisoned. It was a difficult moment for the followers of Ahlul Bayt. But at the same time, when you remember that Imam al-Jawad was buried and all the limbs, his body was intact, yes, internally, he was destroyed by that poison. And then you compare the death and the shahada of Imam al-Jawad with Abi Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam, then you come to know that the shahada of Abi Abdullah, it was a difficult one to remember.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned. One good lesson my father taught me regarding how to behave with my wife was decreasing the number of my illogical expectations in life. For instance, if I do not provide enough substance for cooking, then I can't expect delicious food to be ready on time. In other words, men must not make their wives anxious by asking illogical requests. Women have delicate souls and their souls are broken easily. Men must be aware of this.
وقتی لطافتش رو از دست بده دیگه برای مردش آرامش بخش نیست برای اون بچه‌ش هم دیگه مربی و
If a woman loses her delicate soul then she can't provide calmness and peace for her husband. She also can't nurture her children in a good way. Based on Islam, the responsibilities of a wife and husband are clear. As Prophet Muhammad taught Imam Ali alayhi salam and Hazrat Fatima on the day of their marriage, the affairs inside the house are on the shoulders of a wife and the affairs outside the house are on the shoulders of the husband. Upon hearing this, Lady Fatima stated, O Father, this has been the happiest words I have ever heard in my life. In better words, the words of Prophet Muhammad were compatible with the delicate and fine soul of Hazrat Fatima az-Zahra as a woman. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hojatul Islam Mandegari. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
In the limelight.
Across Britain this winter, more people are falling into debt and sitting in cold and damp homes as a result of rising energy bills, which have helped push the country's inflation rate above 10%. This sharp increase is called fuel poverty, which happens when 10% of household income is spent on energy bills. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote in this regard, the upcoming recession is expected to trigger a wave of payment defaults in the UK. As the cost of living crisis squeezes British households, many have fallen behind on their bills, according to Consumer Insight Tracker. Data released recently shows that an estimated 1.9 million households have failed to make at least one mortgage, rent, loan, credit card, or other bill payment over the last month. The figure is up from 1.7 million households this time last year. The report indicated that missed payment rates generally tend to be lower in the lead up to the holiday period and peak in January, when many households in the UK have to pay back their Christmas expenses. The data suggests that there could be a significant wave of payment defaults in the coming months as the UK heads into recession, and consumers will only face further financial pressures in 2023. Data shows that energy bills have been missed the most, 2.3% of households, followed by council tax, that is 1.9%. Overall, renters were more likely to have missed the housing payment. Of those surveyed, 3.1% reported having missed a loan or credit card payment. Rakio Kancha, director of policy, said, "We are worried that many more people could be facing financial crisis in January as the credit repayments pile up and the cost of living crisis continues to bite. As so many people face financial hardship, it's calling on businesses in essential sectors like food, energy, and broadband providers to do more to help customers get a good deal and avoid unnecessary or unfair costs and charges during this crisis." According to the latest report by research group GfK, consumer confidence in the UK has remained at its lowest level in almost 50 years for 8 months now, as households across the UK grapple with the deepening cost of living crisis. Inflation in the UK reached 10.7% in November, according to the Office for National Statistics, which is more than five times the 2% target. Guardian also reported, with the UK heading into recession, mortgages and rent costs rising, and the energy price guarantee becoming less generous from April, consumers will only face further financial pressures in 2023, leading to more defaults, it warned. Unsurprisingly, perhaps the most common type of bill missed was energy, at 2.3% of households, followed by council tax at 1.9%. Overall, renters were more likely to have missed the housing payment. Of those surveyed, 3.1% reported having missed the loan or credit card payment. As so many people face financial hardship, the UK government is calling on businesses in essential sectors like food, energy and broadband providers to do more to help customers to get a good deal and avoid unnecessary or unfair costs and charges during the crisis. Last week, the Bank of England warned that significant pressure on households and businesses due to higher inflation and borrowing costs. About 4 million households in the UK are likely to face higher mortgage payments in 2023, with the average monthly mortgage payment rising to £1,000, up from £750, the equivalent to about 17% of pre-tax income. Earlier this month, the Trades Union Congress said 2022 has seen the sharpest fall in real wages since 1977 and the second worst on record since 1945. Analysis of official statistics found that the real wages fell by an average of £76 a month in 2022 as a result of pay not keeping pace with inflation. A year ago, the average household was spending around £1,200 on electricity and gas bills. Now that figure is £2,500. UK food price inflation hit a new high of 12.4% in November.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Secretary General of Iran's High Council for Human Rights, Kazem Gharibabadi, has slammed the French government's crackdown on protesters, saying Paris is violently silencing the voice of dissent.
France's heavy-handed crackdown on peaceful protesters proved the extent of its disregard for human rights. The French government violently silences the voice of dissent. Double standards vis-à-vis human rights have taken a new turn, or what?
Widespread protests erupted in Paris in the wake of a deadly shooting by a gunman at a Kurdish cultural center and nearby cafe on Friday in a busy part of Paris's 10th district.
If it is possible to enter a cultural center with a gun during the day, it means that there is not enough security. It's the kind of thing you only see in France. In other countries, it's not like that. There is no security.
Police arrested a 69-year-old suspect who the French authorities said had recently been freed from detention while awaiting trial for a saber attack on a migrant camp in the capital a year earlier. The attacker killed three people and injured three others. The suspect confessed to a pathological hatred for foreigners and spent nearly a day in a psychiatric facility before being returned to police custody on Sunday. Judicial officials in France have charged the man with murder and attempted murder because of race, ethnicity, nationality, or religion, as well as for the unauthorized procurement and possession of a weapon. The killings also drew Kurdish groups and their supporters onto the streets of Paris. Brimming with fury, the protesters, holding flags and chanting slogans, became disruptive at one point, broke the street railings, and set bins on fire, which led to clashes with police forces after they used tear gas and water cannons to scatter the indignant demonstrators. Police said there had been 11 arrests. Local media reports as well as witnesses said the French police spared no effort to quash the protests as they resorted to excessive use of force in what was literally construed as a heavy-handed crackdown on dissent. In reaction to the French police crackdown on demonstrators, Iran has urged the French government to respect the rights of protesters. In a statement, Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani urged the French law enforcement forces to exercise self-restraint while dealing with peaceful protesters. Kanani said the French government has a track record of dealing with protesters violently and a background of adopting discriminatory policies toward minorities and migrants. Between November 2018 and January 2019, at least 12 people died during the French security forces' crackdown on the Yellow Vest protests against the living and economic conditions across the European country. Friday's shooting drew Kurdish groups and their supporters onto the streets of the French capital, with some of the protesters waving flags of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, which is viewed as a terrorist organization by Turkey and its Western allies. Other protesters chanted anti-Turkey slogans and held banners with mottos accusing Ankara of being a killer state and connected to the shooting.
We're obviously targeted by Turkey, by Erdogan's regime, as it was the case on January 9, 2013, during the triple murder of Kurdish activists. So today, there is a second time, a repetition of history. Three people again were killed on the eve of the 10th anniversary. And so we reiterate again that for us, there is no doubt that these are political assassinations orchestrated by Turkey.
The French ambassador was summoned after Ankara said French officials did little to stop the anti-Turkey propaganda promoted by the outlawed PKK militants in Paris. The ministry accused the PKK of spreading false information about Ankara's involvement in the shooting. It said the French government and some of its politicians are being used as a tool in this campaign. The ministry urged French authorities to properly look into the violent crimes committed by the terrorist organization. Over the past years, Turkey's relations with France have been stained by their opposing stances on the war in Syria and a range of other disputes. The PKK militants, designated as terrorists by Turkey, the United States, and European Union, regularly clash with Turkish forces in the Kurdish-dominated southeast of the country, which is attached to northern Iraq. A shaky ceasefire between the PKK and the Turkish government collapsed in July 2015. Attacks on Turkish security forces have soared ever since. More than 40,000 people have been killed during the three-decade conflict between Turkey and the autonomy-seeking militant group. Thousands of Moroccans have staged demonstrations across the North African country to reiterate their unwavering support for the Palestinian cause and voice outrage at the U.S.-sponsored normalization of diplomatic relations with Israel on its second anniversary. People from all strata of society heeded a call by the Moroccan Front in support of Palestine and against normalization, took part in nationwide rallies in almost 30 cities to show solidarity with Palestinians and censure Rabat's normalization of ties with the Tel Aviv regime. Protesters converged outside the Parliament of Morocco premises in the capital Rabat, where they chanted slogans in condemnation of the normalization and demanded the reversal of the agreement. The demonstrators waved national Palestinian flags and held up placards that read, "Normalization is treacherous and the struggle will carry on until the normalization is revoked" in Arabic. The participants also set fire to the Israeli flag in front of the legislature's building. The people of Morocco have repeatedly expressed their opposition to the agreement by holding demonstrations and protests. The Moroccan Front in support of Palestine and against normalization said normalization with the regime is passionately opposed by the whole country. On December 2020, Israel and Morocco announced the resumption of diplomatic relations after their suspension in 2000 following the outbreak of the Second Palestinian Intifada. The two agreed to normalize relations by signing a deal brokered by the U.S., making the North African country the fourth Arab state to strike such a deal with the regime. The others were the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan. As part of the accord, Washington agreed to recognize Morocco's sovereignty over the Western Sahara region, which has been at the center of a dispute with neighboring Algeria. Algiers had condemned the U.S. decision, saying it had no legal effect because it contradicts UN resolutions, especially UN Security Council resolutions on Western Sahara. Morocco and Algeria have long been at odds over the disputed territory of Western Sahara, while Algiers-backed Polisario Front is seeking independence from Rabat's rule. Algeria cut diplomatic ties with Morocco in August 2021, citing hostile acts. Rabat controls over 80% of the territory and is pushing for autonomy under its sovereignty. The Polisario Front, however, wants a UN-sponsored referendum on self-determination. Morocco, like any other Arab country that has recognized Israel, insists it will still work for a two-state solution, but this time by engaging with Israel rather than boycotting it. Morocco clearly decided that developing its economic ties with Israel and winning U.S. recognition of its sovereignty in Western Sahara were too important to pass up. According to an opinion poll conducted by the Arab Barometer, 59% of Moroccans say they are hostile to normalization between Rabat and Tel Aviv. This shows a marked discrepancy between official authorities and Moroccan public opinion. The chasm was further exposed by the rise of several political parties that have accused the Moroccan state of betraying the Palestinian cause and collaborating with Israeli settlers. For example, the Justice and Development Party called for the closure of the Israeli liaison office during the bombing of Gaza last year. The Unified Socialist Party and the Socialist Democratic Vanguard Party showed their opposition to the rapprochement with Israel as well. They called it an illegitimate agreement. With all the opposition and outrage over inking the normalization agreement with Israel, why should Rabat do this? While the normalization was enacted in December 2020, bilateral relations between Morocco and Israel had never fully ceased in the past. In fact, in 2014, hundreds of diplomatic letters leaked by a Moroccan activist revealed that the two had been maintaining an ongoing political dialogue. Similarly, Israeli records reported $37 million in trade with Morocco in 2017, as well as signing of several trade and economic agreements. The diplomatic normalization was simply an opportunity for the kingdom to recognize and strengthen a cooperation that has always existed.
This Christmas is not a time for cheers and festivities for many in the U.S. A hunger crisis is affecting U.S. households. Food insecurity is already a critical problem affecting millions of Americans. One of the most typical factors affecting people suffering from food insecurity this time of the year are extreme winter conditions. But this year especially, many are suffering from hunger and high food prices due to unprecedented inflation that has gripped the U.S.
The gas, the food, everything, milk, egg, everything is high now.
It is concerning, so I always shop online to make sure that I can find the best prices for groceries and for, like, gas as well.
Last year, more than 33 million Americans lived in food-insecure households, including 9 million children. The figure dropped in 2021 thanks to COVID relief programs. One also does not need to look any further than U.S.'s food assistance program called SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, to see the severity of the problem. The federal government increased SNAP by 12.5% this fall, adjusted to the rate of inflation. In the fiscal year 2021, SNAP served an average of 41.5 million people per month. The U.S. President Joe Biden may boast of a minor drop in inflation.
And yesterday, we got data that showed that manufacturing orders were up, but cost increases in supply chain items were beginning to ease. The week before that, we got data showing that price increase may be beginning to ease as well.
But the fact of the matter is that the U.S. population is suffering from poverty, unemployment, a lack of affordable housing, and lack of access to health care. This is on top of systemic racial inequities. All of these factors have driven food insecurity that affects around 10% of U.S. households. Many people in the UK are also struggling to make ends meet during Christmas time, especially when it comes to food. That is since the UK economy is suffering from negative economic growth that has led many to be food insecure. Driven mainly by soaring energy prices, UK inflation has been running high in 2022, reaching successive new records. In October, households paid 88.9% more on average for electricity, gas, and other fuels than a year ago. So it is natural then that there has been a multifold increase when it comes to people going to food banks. One sobering statistic is that there are now more food banks than McDonald's in the UK. Between April and September, more than 320,000 people in the UK walked into food banks of Trussell Trust, a leading charity fighting against hunger, for the first time, and 1.3 million emergency food parcels were provided across the country. Yet it appears that in the UK, things are a lot worse when it comes to energy bills, especially during the winter time. Families across the UK have to juggle household incomes and make a choice between staying warm or buying food.
So across the UK, we have what we call fuel poverty, which is if you have to spend 10% of your income to afford a decent level of heat and power, you're regarded as being in fuel poverty. September 2021, there are about 4 million households across the UK in fuel poverty.
And that is quite a startling fact, considering how the UK is part of the G7 group of countries. Total wages in the UK have also fallen by 3.9% annually in the quarter to October, accounting for inflation, making the cost of living crisis worse for the average Brit. The natural question is, how did things get down to this, not only for the UK or Europe, but for many other parts of the world, especially during Christmas? Putting COVID aside, the U.S.-backed Ukraine conflict is one major reason, driving up energy prices and hence inflation. Christmas is known to be a time of giving, yet major donations have been going to Ukraine instead of citizens of the donating countries. The Kiel Institute has tracked 93.8 billion euros from 40 countries. Out of that, 52.3 billion euros came from the United States, 29.2 billion euros from the European Union, and 12.3 billion euros from other countries, mostly the United Kingdom.
The salami tactic that Wang Yi is accusing the U.S. of using refers to a practice of using a series of small actions to achieve a much larger end goal that would otherwise be difficult to achieve using one large action. Yi's comments undermine the recent attempts by the leaders of the two biggest economies in the world to reconcile their differences when Joe Biden and Xi Jinping recently met. During Xi Jinping's first in-person meeting with the U.S. president since 2017, the issue of Taiwan was raised. China believes that the U.S. is slowly but surely trying to chip away at China's authority over Taiwan, the incredibly significant industrial island that China deems as its own territory. President Xi calls Taiwan its first red line that the U.S. would be wise not to cross. The intensity of the rhetoric used by both parties to describe the actions of the other party is also escalating.
as Joe Biden objected to China's, quote, coercive and increasingly aggressive actions towards Taiwan. Wang Yi told Blinken that the U.S. shouldn't continue, quote, old routine of unilateral bullying. He also said that the U.S. should not be blinded by ideological prejudices and stop putting obstacles to bilateral relations. Prior to his phone call with Antony Blinken, Wang Yi had already met with the U.S. ambassador to China, Nicholas Burns. During that meeting, he noted that the U.S. and China cannot change each other, and the U.S. shouldn't think about thwarting China all the time. This kind of rhetoric is reflective of the frayed relationship between the two superpowers that are a result of U.S. crackdown on Chinese tech companies, human rights issues, and perhaps the most important of all, the issue of Taiwan, and the U.S. constantly undermining the One China policy. The U.S. has recently put major restrictions on some major Chinese tech firms, including Huawei and ZTE, to the point that their products, along with some other brands, can't even be exported to the U.S. The previous bans that were imposed on these companies during Donald Trump's presidency, when anti-China rhetoric began, were a lot less restrictive. On the topic of human rights, just in the wake of April's shooting incident in New York, the U.S. State Department released reports on human rights situation in other countries, including China, with a handful of accusations thrown in the mix. China rebutted Washington's claims against it by pointing out to its failures in upholding the very human rights they have always championed. The issue of Taiwan is a bit more complicated. In the website of U.S. Department of State, you will find the following paragraph on the U.S.'s supposed official position towards China and Taiwan. The United States' approach to Taiwan has remained consistent across decades and administrations. The United States has a long-standing One China policy, which is guided by the Taiwan Relations Act, the three U.S.-China joint communique, and the Six Assurances. We oppose any unilateral changes to the status quo from either side. We do not support Taiwan independence, and we expect cross-strait differences to be resolved by peaceful means. While the document reads that the U.S. does not support Taiwan's independence, a July 2007 Congressional Research Service report confirms that U.S. policy does not, in fact, recognize China's sovereignty over Taiwan. The document further reads, consistent with the Taiwan Relations Act, the United States makes available defense articles and services as necessary to enable Taiwan to maintain a sufficient self-defense capability and maintain our capacity to resist any resort to force or other forms of coercion that would jeopardize security or the social or economic system of Taiwan. The Taiwan Relations Act was passed right around the time the U.S. recognized the People's Republic of China in 1979. Its intent was so that the U.S. can maintain commercial, cultural, and other relations with Taiwan through unofficial relations without government representation and without formal diplomatic ties. China has since viewed the TRA as, quote, an unwarranted intrusion by the United States into the internal affairs of China. As the U.S. continued to supply Taiwan with arms and, more recently, had official meetings with the leader of the island. And this is where Wang Yi's rhetoric towards Blinken starts to make sense. The U.S. has been playing fast and loose with China's sovereignty over Taiwan and the One China policy. China is on a short fuse, and it remains to be seen when their patience will run out.
Special live coverage for the start of New Year 2023 on Saturday, December 31st at 7:30 p.m. Tehran time, 1600 GMT.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shaheed Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the lives and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia dignitaries and ulama all across the world of Islam. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Muhsin and Shaykh Rouhani. Sayyid Muhsin, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the most outstanding muhaddisin and fuqaha of the Shiite world, the author of two magnum opus, Al-Tahzib wa al-Istibsar, that is Muhammad ibn Hassan ibn Ali ibn al-Hassan, mainly known as Shaykh al-Tusi or Shaykh al-Ta'ifa. Okay, Sayyid Muhsin Naqvi, let's start with you, brother. Give us some details about the early life of Shaykh al-Tusi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Shaykh al-Tusi, known as Shaykh al-Ta'ifa, Shaykh means the...
Head. Of a tribe.
Ta'ifa is the tribe, tribe. Obviously, when we talk about the tribe or ta'if, it means the Shia tribe.
Yes.
And he got the title of the head of the Shia tribe, Shaykh al-Ta'ifa. And he was born in 385 Hijri Qamari, which was the time of Sheikh al-Mufid. Obviously, he has seen Sheikh al-Mufid in his time, because Sheikh al-Mufid passed away in 413 Hijri Qamari. He was born in Tus, which is one of the cities of Khorasan. Obviously, we know that Imam Rada alayhi salam also was buried in Tus, which is known as Mashhad of today.
Yes.
So he was known Tusi because he belonged to the place of Tus. So this, yes, this was the belonging, like where he, yes, used to belong.
Okay.
The way we have different names, like from the cities. So he was born there. He was known as Abu Ja'far, the third Abu Ja'far, because after Sheikh Qulani, the first Abu Ja'far, and then Sheikh Sadduq, the second Abu Ja'far, he was known as the third Abu Ja'far in his time. He was from the students of Sheikh Mufid, and he was there for 5 years with him, and then he benefited from other other scholars as well. He was a so learned person that the, yes, caliph, the Abbasid caliph, he gave him the chair of the theology to Sheikh al-Tusi in Baghdad.
Yes.
And he headed that place. And obviously in his life what we see is he was the founder of the Hawza Ilmiya in Najaf.
That's right.
The Islamic seminary of Najaf.
Mm-hmm.
Although it is said there was a seminary, but obviously, you know, when a person goes there, a personality, and he expands or he gives the advancements to something, obviously he's known as the father. So we can say that he founded and expanded the Islamic seminary in,
yes,
Najaf.
In Najaf.
And later he was buried in Najaf as well.
Yes.
So he was there. And the time when he passed away, he made a will that to change his house to a mosque.
Yes.
And that mosque is still there.
Still
in
available. Yes.
Still available there.
His grave is over there too.
Yes, his grave is in the house, in the,
yes,
masjid.
Yes.
So basically he was one of the theologians, he was one of the jurisprudents, and the advances which he made to the, we can say, in the writing style of the books, basically, because it is said like he was the first person who changed the books as mubawwab.
Mm-hmm.
Mubawwab means bab. Bab is chapter-wise.
Chapter by chapter.
You know, now we have the books chapter by chapter.
Yes.
Chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3.
Okay.
Before that, the books were in the form of amali.
Mm-hmm.
Amali is like, you know, if you use a rough copy,
yes,
a rough notebook, you write a maths today, And after that, if you have the class of, I don't know, physics, kalam, you write down yes. kalam or anything.
Kalam, fiqh, tariq,
so
you know, akhlaq.
Generally, yes. generally, the ulama, they used to write the ahadith and not used to separate them as a chapter.
It was miscellaneous, as we
yes,
say.
As They're a miscellaneous very, yes, yes. Books.
Yes.
So he was the first person who changed the books into the chapter.
Chapter-wise.
Yes. Chapter-wise.
Okay, that's all right. So what about his scholarly look at the Shiite legacy and the world? From among, we can say, the four authentic books of the Shiite world, two belong to Shaykh al-Tusi, and these make him very much great, al-Tahzib and al-Istibsar. Let's talk about his scholarly life, Shaykh Rouhani.
Yes, of course. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. One of the two main works of Shaykh al-Tusi, rahmatullah alayhi, as you rightly mentioned, is al-Istibsar and al-Tahzib. Sometimes we might think that, okay, these scholars, these ulama, they are like traditionists, I mean, mm-hmm. akhbari.
Yes, yes.
Just referring to ahadith. While in reality, as it was discussed about and mentioned about Shaykh Mufid as well, this scholar, I mean, Shaykh Tusi also, they tried to establish a kind of basis for ijtihad as well.
Yes.
In their own times.
Yes.
Because at the time of Ghaybatul Kubra, the major occultation, so of course sometimes they were in need of referring to some of the ahadith, which explained, for example, the new coming kind of issues, but there were yes. no ahadith.
Yes.
So that's why they tried to teach their students for the coming generations to actually sometimes to establish or to found a kind of system based on which they could respond and answer all the questions, particularly the jurisprudential questions about the new coming issues and, let's say, things.
Yes.
So this is one of the important effort that was made by this great scholar. The other one is that Hawza Ilmiya of Najaf, the Islamic Seminary of Najaf, is, we can say, the legacy or the heritage of this scholar
mm-hmm.
because he was the founder of this Hawza al-Ilmiya.
Yes.
So now for 1,000 years,
mm-hmm.
We have great scholars that they were studied there, and they became great, great scholars in the history of Islam.
It's better to say that Shaykh al-Tusi has changed the city of Najaf, into
like
the scholarly,
university
of the Shiite
like
world.
Scholarly city,
the Hawza of which is still active, producing so many outstanding scholars.
Yeah,
that's
and
right.
the other okay. and the other nice point about Shaykh al-Tusi is this, that he tried to preserve the independency of Islamic seminary from the governments.
Mm-hmm.
So they tried to
okay.
To establish a kind of educational system that should be independent from the power, from the kings,
yes.
from the Salatin.
Yes.
Because of what? Because Salatin and kings always, you can say, misuse or make use of these scholars, these educational systems, to spread their own or to let's say, to follow their own
yes.
interests.
Yes, yes.
But if you are independent,
yes.
as nowadays we see Hawzat al-Ilmiya, like Hawzat al-Najaf is always like independent Hawza, it is because of this that they have kind of freedom to talk about each and everything, to issue their fatwas, to actually express their own opinions and ideas. I think this was one of the great efforts that was made by Shaykh al-Tusi and the
right.
next coming scholars to establish a kind of independent Hawzawi
mm-hmm.
system or Islamic seminary system. This is the other point
yes.
which is really significant about Shaykh al-Tusi. And the third point that I want to mention is that it deserves to be mentioned here is that at the time of Shaykh al-Tusi, when Saljuqi Salatin, they conquered Baghdad.
Yes.
Unfortunately, they burned the library of Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
And Shaykh al-Tusi was about to be killed by this
mm-hmm.
Salatin of Saljuqi.
Maybe one of the main reasons to migrate
yeah,
to Najaf
yeah.
was this.
That's
too.
Why, yeah.
Okay.
It was a very good experience for him to make a kind of independent kind of system, independent libraries, independent
mm-hmm.
sources, so that it should not
be away from the attacks.
To be away from the attacks, to be away from these kind of things.
Yes.
So that's why I think he served Tashayyu in a very great way.
That's right.
And he paved the ground for the independency of Hawza al-Ilmiya of Najaf for 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was
That's
one
right.
of the significant
very
points that should be
That's
mentioned.
All right. But why these two books are among the four authentic books, I mean, Al-Istibsar, but Al-Tahzib? What are they exactly about Sayyid Muhsin Nawawi?
Well, when we talk about the first book, Al-Istibsar fi Mukhtalifa min al-Akhbar.
Yes.
This book, the first book, obviously, it is a compilation of the jurisprudic traditions, which is less than the Tahzib al-Ahkam. Mm-hmm. And it is said like it has almost 5,558 hadith or traditions in this book. And he basically made three, chapters in this book. The first two are about the ibadat, the worshipping of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. When we talk about the ibadat, we means like worshipping in the form of prayer, daily prayers, the fasting, the hajj, khums, the zakat, jihad. Obviously, these are known as ibadat.
Yes.
The ones which we known as furu'ad-din, basically, in our Islamic terminology.
Yes.
And the third part was related to uqood, contracts. Mm-hmm. You know, we have the trading contract, we have the marriage contract,
yes.
The ahkam, we have some other things. Hudud, which is like the punishments and all those.
Yes.
Or the diyat is like blood money and all those. So this was the third portion. So basically, he was the first person who I said like he changed the things into chapter wise.
Yes.
So Al-Istibsar had all these things,
okay.
And obviously this was the book of Al-Istibsar, and the
Tahzib. What about Tahzib?
The beauty of the book was he started from the narration of the beginning was started by the narration of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam.
Okay.
For example, about the tahara, about the purification. And then he ended his book with the narration of Imam Sadiq. So he was kind of into this, that if I start this chapter with this imam, I will end the chapter with the same imam. So
these are hadithi books.
Yes, these are hadithi.
But in relation to fiqhi matters?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, obviously, you know, when we talk about the hadithi or fiqhi, now we separate these things. Earlier at that time, it was not separated in this way. This is the advanced, we can say, sciences, when the science is advanced. So we have everything separately. Now, we talk about the, for example, fiqh. Obviously, fiqh is the combination of hadith as well, the Quran and hadith.
Yes.
So what he used to do, he in Tahzib al-Ahkam, the second book that we have, that was the fiqh jurisprudic or ahkam al-shar'i. It has the Islamic law in it. So when he was bringing Islamic law, he used to bring the verses as well. For example, the prayer, about the prayer, this is the specific verse. And in order to, narrate it from the imam, he used to bring the traditions as well from the imam. So these were the books. It's not. It wasn't just mere, the way we have the ruling book right now. For example, the ruling book of Ayatollah Sistani or Ayatollah Khamenei.
Yes.
It just says that, for example, if something has become najis, how to purify it. In these books, they used to bring a hadith.
Yes.
That you need to purify this. This is the hadith. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, for example, has said to do this in this way.
And sorry, sometimes the people found some contradictions, at least in the surface level of the ahadith. I think through this book, especially, Tahzib, they can find the answers to the true sense of the word, okay?
Yes.
Because, for example, on this contract, on this aqd, on this blood money or something like that, we have a tradition from Imam Reza alayhi salam saying something, but we have the same tradition, for example, or a tradition on this matter from Imam Musa Kazem or Imam Hussein, Imam Ali alayhi salam, which seems to be in contradiction when referring to the fiqhi aspect. So this needs to be clarified more.
Yes, it was clarified at that time by these. Obviously, they used to bring different ahadiths and then give their own result.
Yes.
And the same system is followed now as well. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, when a mujtahid at this time, he gives a fatwa, he looks at different ahadiths.
Yes.
The way you said. And then he tries to find out, what is the reason of this? Sometimes, obviously, because of the circumstances, because we do not know why they said so.
Yes.
What was the circumstances? Because everything is according to. And sometimes this is something which is, we call it kulli.
General.
General. A general law is something else. A specific thing is something else. So sometimes because we are unaware of the background, that's why we have these, we see these contradictions. But obviously, the ulama, the scholar, especially the Shaykh al-Ta'ifa, he has attended to this matter and he wrote Tahzib al-Ahkam in the same way. Allah, 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 Allah.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Even among the first exegesis of the Holy Quran, At-Tabyan fi Tafsil al-Quran, which is still referred to, is among the most outstanding works of Sheikh At-Tusi. What about the other works, Sheikh Rouhani? Do we have, for example, another work outstanding?
Yes, of course. You know, Sheikh At-Tusi rahmatullah alayhi was a mufassir and interpreter of the Holy Quran. As well, he was a theologian. He was a faqih. That's why in all these different fields of studies, he was also adib. A literary kind of figure
yes.
as well.
Yes, yes.
So in all these areas, he has some works. But I think the 2 points that should be focused on here in this episode is this, that first of all, we should know that the Imam alayhim salatu wassalam, Imam Hassan alayhi salam, Imam Hussein, and Imam Sajjad. These yes. three Imams did not have any chance, we can say, to spread the teachings because the situation was so much problematic mm-hmm. and difficult for them. Imam Kadhim alayhi salatu wasalam, it says that for 19 years he was captured, he was imprisoned by yes. Harun al-Rashid. And Imam Hadi, Imam Hassan al-Askari, and Imam Jawad. These three yes. imams also were under the control of the Abbasid caliphs. Mm-hmm. They could not do a lot. The only imams they had a bit chance to spread the teachings of Islam is Imam al-Sadiq, Imam al-Baqir, Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam. Yes. So, these three imams had this chance to teach the people the doctrines and teachings of Islam. That's why these scholars like Sheikh Tusi, if they collected lots of ahadith, lots yes. of traditions, lots yes. of narrations, because they knew, okay, the rest of the imams did not have the chance. So only these three great imams had the chance. So that's why they tried their best to collect as much as they could, all right. different traditions, narration, ahadith, by traveling here and there, searching different libraries, sometimes put themselves into mm-hmm. dangers. And this way, I think they played a very great role, and these kind of ahadith right. book are really, really important. But, of course, okay. they were not only the narrators or yes. transmitters of ahadith.
No.
Because
they were, as you said, the thinkers.
Yeah, the thinkers
yes,
as well.
The organizers.
Exactly.
Yes, yes.
And the other point is that, unfortunately, in the history of Islam, if you see that, all the different people that sometimes they are misguided or mm. deceived by the different, let's say, sects or so-called scholars, who do scholars, is by the Quran. Mm-hmm. Sometimes Quran is misinterpreted.
Yes, yes.
So one of the great effort that they made is in regard with the Holy Quran.
That's right.
That, for example, this Shaykh At-Tusi, rahmatullah alayhi, start to interpret the ayat of the Quran.
Very good.
Not only explain, rather to examine, to assess the other interpretations as well.
Based on ahadith.
Yeah, yeah, based on ahadith.
This is important.
And based on aql.
This is important.
And based on okay. the viewpoints of the other scholars. Because sometimes, right. for example, some of the other scholars may misinterpret some of the ayat, some of the ahadith.
Yes.
So then, Shaykh At-Taif, Shaykh At-Tusi, rahmatullah alayhi, try to interpret truly the ayat of the Quran by ahadith, if they were ahadith, if not by the pure, let's say, principles or aql or rational kind of ideas of the shayyur. I think this was very much important that Shaykh At-Tusi rahmatullah alayhi has done, because
yes.
Quran is the most and the first and the most important source of ahkam, source
That's
of
right.
Islamic teachings and doctrines. That's why these scholars refer to the Quran as well. And
okay.
Yeah, this is the
That's
point
right.
that there is a very nice story about Imam Hassan al-Askari, that once the Muslim philosopher Kendi
yes.
Once wanted to write a book saying that, okay, in the Quran there are something wrong, false, al-ayadu billah, God forbid. Then Imam al-Hassan al-Askari, through one of his students, told him that, okay, you might misunderstand mm-hmm. this ayat. It
yes.
is because of misconception that you have from the ayat al-Quran. No, not because of the ayat al-Quran itself. So you see, by this way, Imam Hassan al-Askari taught the scholars of the Shayyu, like Sheikh Tusi, that, okay, sometimes you have this responsibility to interpret the Holy Quran.
Right.
Because in every century, we can say, in every time, we need the new interpretations of the Holy Quran. That's why in every centuries, we should have new interpretation of the Holy Quran by the great scholars.
Yes.
Because there are lots of misunderstanding, misinterpretation of the ayat of the Quran. That's why I think from this perspective also, the role of Sheikh Tusi and the history of the Shia in Islam is very great.
Also, ahadith, as you said, are misinterpreted because of maybe lack of the knowledge, because that is the Kalam al-Masum. The Kalam al-Masum is very much close to revelation even, okay? We might not understand the mere text, and the literal translation will not answer. That's why they refer you.
And also, the other important point was this, that many times in the history, our ahadith, our libraries were burned.
Burned.